welcome to Tea and Strumpets, a Regency Romance Review. I'm Zoe.
And I'm Kelsey.
And Kelsey, I heard recently that you took a trip across the pond. You have left us in merry old England and read at least two books set in the U.S.
Oh, I have, actually. So actually, I've read three books. I've majorly ventured across the pond. So I have recently been reading Maya Rodale's Gilded Age series. That's not the correct name of it, but it's set in the Gilded Age. And I was given her third book, which I was very excited to get. And it is so funny because I'd already put the first book in my Kindle. So I was gifted the third book as a real book. And then I had already had the first book in the Kindle. So I finally found time to read it. And oh, I loved it so much. I haven't gotten to the third one yet, but because I had to take a break and read other things. But I'm so excited to get on to that one.
So, confession over here, I'm halfway through the third book, but I have not read the first two. Oh. I am enjoying it too. I know, sacrilege of us enjoying these newfangled American books.
Yes.
Who is surprised? I mean, no, of course. I mean, it's Maya Rodale and we love her writing. And yes, I was also gifted the third book because Maya so graciously sent us each a copy. So thank you, Maya, and we're both enjoying your series.
Yes, we really are. And Zoe, you need to find time to read the first two because they are so cute. And let me talk about like female power and like good working relationships and
Yeah, I'm excited. I think I'm getting snippets of some of the other characters in this book, like from that. And I'm just like, oh, I really now kind of want to know more about them. And yeah. So, but I read a lot of books this weekend. So I will get the other one, the other ones of the series into my pile. But one of the books that I did read this weekend was the book that we're talking about today.
Yes, I also had to read this real fast. And man, I loved it. Sorry. Spoiler alert.
We aren't supposed to spoiler, but I loved it too. And I can't wait to talk more about it because this one I did not remember loving. And ooh, I can't wait to get into it.
We shall. So today we are reading It Happened One Midnight by Julie Ann Long. And this is the story of Jonathan Redmond.
Woo, back to the Redmonds. So we have a short author fact this week, which is sort of an author fact. It's tangential, which is that Julie Ann Long's been putting out all of the Pennyroyal Green books in audio. Woo-hoo! And the final book, The Legend of Lion Redman, is being released on July 14th, which is the day before this will air, or 2 days, I think, maybe before this will air.
But yeah, it's
so,
Tuesday.
So if you don't have time to read the Pennyroyal Green series, you can now listen to it entirely.
Yes. You can.
So pretty cool.
Yes.
And you should.
You really should. I mean, if you can't read it in audiobooks or your thing, like, check this series out because super.
Oh, it's so good. Oh, anyhow.
Yes. So for our history fact today, we are actually going to talk about child labor. Yeah, not so great. But this is a huge topic in the book. And so I wanted to give a little context to child labor. So child labor has existed to varying extents throughout history. During the 19th and early 20th centuries, many children aged 5 to 14 from poorer families worked in Western nations and their colonies alike. These children mainly worked in agriculture, home-based assembly operations, factories, mining, and services such as newsboys. However, some worked night shifts lasting 12 hours. With the rise of household income, availability of schools, and passage of child labor laws, the incidence rates of child labor fell. Now, the Victorian era in particular became notorious for the conditions under which children were employed. Children as young as 4 were employed in production, factories, and mines, working long hours in dangerous, often fatal, working conditions. In coal mines, children could crawl through tunnels too narrow and low for adults. Children also worked as errand boys, crossing sweepers, shoeblacks, or selling matches, flowers, and other cheap goods. Some children took work as apprentices and other respectable trades, but what we're really focusing on today is the work in factories. So the less desirable working conditions, which consisted of long hours and truly dangerous work for these children to be doing. Mm-hmm. Throughout the second half of the 19th century, child labor began to decline in industrialized societies due to regulation and economic factors because of the growth of trade unions. The regulation of child labor began from the earliest days of the Industrial Revolution. The first act to regulate child labor in Britain was passed in 1803. As early as 1802 and 1819, factory acts were passed to regulate working hours of workhouse children in factories and cotton mills to 12 hours per day. Oh, how nice of them. The children only need to work for half the 24 hours of the day.
It's only half. Come on. Yeah. They have so much time with the other half.
These acts were largely ineffective, and after radical agitation, in 1833, children aged 11 to 18 should work a maximum of 12 hours per day, children aged 9 to 11 a maximum of 8 hours, and children under the age of 9 were no longer permitted to work. So 1833, guys. If you were under 9, yikes, you were out of a job. This act, however, only applied to the textile industry, and further agitation led to another act in 1847, limiting both adults and children to 10-hour working days. Now, you also saw, as technology improved and proliferated, there was a greater need for educated employees. So really what helped to deter child labor was an increase in schooling with the eventual introduction of compulsory schooling. And then improved technology and automation also made child labor redundant. So yay, no more children working in factories.
Yeah, I was trying – the child labor is – it comes up a lot in our books because this was a time where reform started happening. Factories started, you know, really booming, and so reform started happening. Now, during the time that we like to read, like you said earlier, there really was still a lot of bad stuff going on. But yeah, in our book today, we get to talk a little bit about that. And it's so interesting because I was watching Antiques Roadshow, and I was trying to just now look up and see if I could find the name of this place. But they went to a site, Antiques Roadshow UK goes to these incredible like castles, okay, usually for each of their episodes. And they went to one that had been an old textile mill. And I can't remember the name of it. And I think it was built in the late 1700s. And the guy who had built it had been a revolutionary type. Mm-hmm. And he had built these like really quote unquote nice residences for everyone. He said that if they had everything that they needed there, like they would be happier. Mm-hmm. He built schools for the children, and the children had to go to the school, and the school promoted like creativity and like thought over like serious learning.
Okay.
It was just like, wow, what? So anyhow, I thought this would be such an interesting thing to talk about one of these days. Not today. I got to remember the name of it. Sorry, I don't remember it here.
She's got to remember the name so she can do more research.
Exactly. It was so cool. I know I have the episode still on my TV, so I can go back and listen to it. But I'm excited to talk about our book. So let's get into our tropes so that we can get into our book.
Yes.
So our main tropes are kind of like, they're not real like strong tropes. I don't know. I didn't have something, you know, yeah, it wasn't like enemies to lovers, I mean, like, or something like that.
You could say class difference, but...
You could say class difference for sure, but there is definitely that like the family has threatened that they have to marry, yeah, and they have to marry within a certain time and they have to marry a certain like status, otherwise they'll, mm-hmm, be cut off. So however you want to like shorten that down, that's there. And there's also a little bit of a Robin Hood,
yes,
kind of aspect
to this one.
There's
a bit of a Robin Hood. In fact, it is mentioned in the book.
It is.
So our main characters today are Mr. Jonathan Redman and Miss Thomasina Tommy de Ballesteros.
All right. Well, let's get into this synopsis.
Yes, we are going to. So Miss Thomasina de Ballesteros is outside the home of the Duke of Greyfolk. She's trying to get a good look at the man when suddenly she hears the sound of a pistol being cocked. Mr. Jonathan Redman was out smoking a cheroot after having dinner at the Duke of Greyfolk's house when he noticed Tommy in the shadows. Thinking the figure in the shadows was up to no good, Jonathan drew his pistol, which causes Tommy to turn. Quote, he wasn't precisely aiming the thing at her, but he held it with the same casual ease with which he held the cheroot. She had no doubt he knew how to use it. She'd heard about how he allegedly, nonchalantly shot the hearts out of targets at Manton's with tedious predictability.
Luckily, the two just happened to have met earlier that day. Tommy often acts as a companion for the Countess of Mirabeau, who hosts a weekly salon. Jonathan had accompanied his friend Argosy there, where he met Tommy. Seeing her outside the Duke of Greyfolk's home is intriguing, to say the least. They exchange pleasantries, sort of, and part ways.
With them, pleasantries and insults are the same thing.
Yes.
But as we know, this is just our first meeting. And Jonathan muses over the woman as he heads out of London for Pennyroyal Green. Quote, "She looked just a bit too comfortable in the shadows. Even if he'd never seen her lurking outside of the Duke of Greyfolk's house at midnight, even if she'd never said, 'I carry a knife for protection if I'm out at night, I do know how to use it,' he would have known Tommy de Ballesteros was trouble. It didn't prevent him from liking her."
For Tommy's part, she is equally as intrigued by Mr. Redmond. Quote, "And later it was that she would remember about this particular midnight, the wicked flash of his grin in the dark, like a much more beautiful and dangerous twin of that moon. She ought to have been warned."
While Jonathan is in Pennyroyal Green, he visits with Violet, who is very pregnant at this point, and is using her pregnancy to get whatever she wants, per usual. This is how Jonathan is roped into going to see Madame Heron again. He's been avoiding the gypsy camp since Martha Heron had given him his prediction about many, many children. That's a throwback to book two.
However, before he ventures to the gypsy encampment, his father apparently would like a word with him. Jonathan is hoping it's to tell him he's been admitted to the Mercury Club, but sadly, it's not that. Isaiah Redman instead issues Jonathan an ultimatum. Jonathan must be married within a year, and it's already June, to a woman that Isaiah approves of. Otherwise, he'll be cut off. After that, maybe then Isaiah will take him seriously for membership to the Mercury Club. And again, the Mercury Club is an investment club.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan tries to tell him that he's more than suitable to join. But since all his money is currently tied up in an investment venture, you know, you got to spend money to make money, Isaiah brushes him off. Quote, "My father really does believe I'm stupid," he thought, in some surprise. "Or at best, he thinks I'm a feckless child." And for a moment, he sat feeling strangely hollow, as if someone had just taken a spoon and scooped him out like a melon.
The meeting does conclude with Jonathan sharing some interesting news. He dined with the Duke of Greyfolk the previous evening, and the Duke is intent to buy the same mill that Isaiah and the Mercury Club are after. Isaiah is interested in this information, but it does not change his mind about Jonathan. So this meeting is a blow to Jonathan for three reasons. The first being that he had hoped that the Mercury Club would be interested in investing in a new color printing venture that Jonathan believed had a lot of promise. The second, that now apparently he was supposed to get married to someone, a fate Jonathan has actively been avoiding since Martha Heron's ominous prediction. And the third is the biggest blow. His family seems to have no idea who he is as a person, and their opinion of him is frankly very low.
The next day, Jonathan accompanies Violet to the gypsy encampment before heading to London. The meeting does not produce anything so ominous, but it does sound like Violet is going to have a girl that breaks hearts. While there, Violet and Martha tease Jonathan about the previous prediction, you know, from all those many books ago, causing Jonathan to leave in a huff. Violet follows him, quote, "Jonathan, it's just, why are you so distressed? One day you will need to care about something. Why not children?" He stared at her, genuinely struck dumb. He opened his mouth. A dry squeaking noise emerged. And when he was finally able to form words, they were all hoarse. "I need to care? I need to care. Does anybody bloody know me? Do you really think I don't care about things, as you say?" Jonathan then proceeds to tell Violet about Isaiah's ultimatum. And she, very eloquently, as all Violet will do, says, "You know, you'd think Father would learn. He's always forbidding things or making rulings, and everyone ends up doing precisely the opposite of his wishes, or at least not acquiescing to them."
Yeah, sadly, the man has not learned his lesson. Mm-hmm. And now we get to figure out just how Jonathan is going to beat him. So back in London, Tommy is at the racetrack, once again hovering around the Duke of Greyfolk. Jonathan is there to do the same thing since his father is not going to help him invest in the color printing, and he's hoping that maybe the Duke can. Before either one of them catch the Duke's eyes, though, they are distracted by a commotion. A boy has been caught stealing an apple by the owner of a cart. The man takes the apple, but instead of just telling the boy to go, he starts shaking him with intent to do more harm. Tommy is about to rush in when suddenly someone gets there first. Quote, "Why don't you unhand him now?" Jonathan's tone was pleasant, almost gentle, very, very controlled. Something about it made the tiny hairs stand up on the back of her neck. She wondered if the costermonger recognized the grave threat. Jonathan is a threat. When the costermonger does not immediately unhand the boy, he steps in bodily. The boy gets away and Jonathan gets punched in the face, but lands far more of his own punches.
Once things dissipate, Tommy assists Jonathan get cleaned up. Watching him step in for a kid from the streets has cast him in a new light. A potentially useful one. The following week, Jonathan is present at the Countess's weekly salon. Tommy uses the time to learn a bit more about Jonathan's newest venture and even promises to invest in it, since he's made very compelling arguments as to its potential. While she cannot give him the money now, she'd be happy to give it to him if he meets her at the Half Moon Theater in Covent Garden at midnight.
Jonathan is not about to meet this woman at midnight. She's trouble. He knew it from the moment that they met. And come midnight, Jonathan is in front of the Half Moon Theater. Apparently, he cannot resist her brand of trouble. Tommy arrives and leads him on a very circuitous route to a boarding house. There, Tommy gives him an exquisite set of pearls. He is welcome to sell them and use the proceeds to invest in the printing venture. However, in return for her investment, she may need a favor from time to time. And the first favor will need to be done tonight. Quote, "Of course." Here it was. Trouble. He could hear it coming, like a herd of stampeding horses, far, far off.
Jonathan reluctantly agrees, and the two head out into the night. The favor turns out to be a rescue mission. They liberate Sally, a scullery maid in a nice house. Turns out the Lord's son has no issue with beating 7-year-old Sally for minor infractions. Quote, "What happened to your head, Sally?" "Master William coshed me," she said softly. She was young enough to lisp. "And when he did, I fell and broke me crown." Master William was Lord Feckwith the Younger, who was Jonathan's age and easily 3 times the size of Sally. Could this be true? Tommy's eyes were on Jonathan. She seemed to be holding her breath. "Why?" he asked Sally finally. The word was a bit choked. Though he suspected, the answer was, because he could.
Jonathan is floored, even more so when he is informed by Tommy that kids like Sally are sold from the workhouse. The kids, who do not know what they are doing, are promised the world in exchange for a shilling to sign a piece of paper. Instead of getting good opportunities like they are promised, they are sold to people as cheap labor until they are 21. Most of the kids do not even reach that age. What is even crazier to Jonathan is that Sally, who has been traumatized by a man about his size and age, completely trusts him when Tommy names him Mr. Friend. Quote, "He knew a brief, sudden sweep of vertigo, near terror, as if he were walking a wire strung between buildings. God, what a perilous thing it was to be a child, to go from screaming Luby to unquestioning, trusting innocent in the space of a single hackney ride. And this, he suspected, was perfectly typical child behavior."
After Jonathan is dropped off, Tommy heads back to her room to await the doctor. He's always been discreet about what she does, and does good work. This time is different, though. As he leaves, he tells Tommy that his rate has gone up. Now money is not all he requires. She can pay him in sex instead. He'll return tomorrow for payment. While she is shocked by this turn of events, she's not too worried. Her upstairs neighbor, Rutherford, is a big man and will protect her from unwanted advances. Tommy has miscalculated, though. The next day, she's in her rooms when she hears an extra large thump from Rutherford's room. And when she arrives to check out the commotion, it turns out the doctor has slipped Rutherford a sedative. Sally is asleep in the other room, so they can just do what they have to do. Tommy tries to talk her way out of it, but gets backed into a corner, literally. As the doctor starts lifting her skirts, suddenly, he disappears.
Jonathan, not at all satisfied with Tommy's explanations from the night before, has found his way back to her boarding house and has arrived just in time. He makes quick work of the doctor by demonstrating how he will kill him if he ever bothers Tommy again. Quote, the painting crashed to the floor. The scissors remained embedded in the wall, vibrating. They'd severed the ribbon. Tommy slowly turned to stare at him in awe. I'll replace the frame, Jonathan said absently. The doctor was gaping. It makes surreptitious murder so easy, as you can see, Doctor. When I throw it at you, the dart tip will be dipped in poison, and it will enter that vein throbbing right there in your slimy, scrawny white neck. I never miss. Would you like another demonstration? Shall I give you a head start and then track you down with a dart?
Whew. That took care of that villain. Now that he's vanquished a foe, Jonathan gets more answers from Tommy. Turns out she's been liberating children for a while, placing them in better situations after absconding with them into the night. And Jonathan is impressed. Quote, he couldn't speak through the enormity of this. His hands went up to push through his hair. It's madness, Tommy. His voice was frayed. He was awed by just how mad and dangerous it truly was. Mad and dangerous and grand and noble and wildly unexpected. Never would he have dreamed it about her. The slimly elegant Tommy de Ballesteros, she of the gossamer clothing and effervescent charm. She was a Robin Hood of sorts, a bloody lioness.
Tommy also points out that Jonathan is kind of the same as her. He will step in to help anyone. He's been sporting a bruise and a new scar from an altercation outside a gaming hell. He stepped in when he saw a group of guys jump an innocent man. Quote, not everyone intervenes, Mr. Redman. You simply have no choice. It's your nature. I haven't a choice, he repeated faintly, with grim resignation. And he proves that even more when he finds a good home for Sally. He uses his family's standing as donors to get Sally admitted to Miss Endicott's Academy in Pennyroyal on scholarship.
As Tommy and Jonathan leave, he tells her he'll get her a carriage back to London. He's planning to stop in Pennyroyal to visit with his sister. Quote, she smiled. You're fond of your sister. My sister is a trial. She is currently immensely with child. In other words, you're fond of your sister. He laughed. Laughing with him was strangely a bit like drinking champagne. She wanted more of it, and the more she had of it, the giddier she felt.
However, before she catches her ride back to London, Tommy and Jonathan take a walk. As they're chatting and laughing, suddenly Tommy undresses and makes a dive off the side of a footbridge and into the river below. Jonathan panics until he sees Tommy emerge to the surface. He then dives in to assist her. What kind of crazy lady jumps into a river in a full shift in petticoats?
When they reach the shore, Tommy is still upset. She had dropped something into the river. Jonathan spies a bit of red ribbon and heads back in to fish it out. It turns out to be a medal with the Duke of Greyfolk's name on the back. Jonathan is furious. First, he demands why she just jumped into the river without thought to the consequences. Quote, I didn't think to do that. Her voice was frayed now. She was staring at him wonderingly. And then she straightened her spine and threw her shoulders back, realizing his temper was driving her like a nail into the ground. All my life, if something needed to be done, Jonathan, well, then I have always simply done it. The medal was floating away, and there was no time to discuss it, so it didn't occur to me to chat about it. You see, I'm just not in the habit of... That is, there's never been anyone who... She stopped abruptly, clamped her mouth shut.
Since Jonathan has always had a family, this is a bit of a surprising realization to him. It hurts to hear, but he still has an opinion on the subject. Quote, from now on, you will take 3 seconds to assess whether whatever it is you're about to do is dangerous. If the answer is yes, I want you to tell me, and if it absolutely must be done, I will do it instead. You can trust me to do it. Do we have a bargain? He expected mutiny. She studied him, her expression cool, assessing now. Very well, she agreed softly, regally, as if giving him a gift. Strangely, the relief he felt made it seem as though he'd received one.
The next question. He asks her why she has the Duke's medal. Turns out, she's the Duke's illegitimate child by his Spanish mistress. He was awarded the medal and gave it to his mistress before leaving her once the fighting had stopped. Tommy's mother gave it to her on her deathbed, saying she should bring it to her father if ever she needed help. Jonathan asks where Tommy went after her mother died. To the workhouse.
And now he understands her motives, why she cares for the children no one seems to care about. He also understands why he was so mad when she went over the bridge. Quote, and now he knew. There had been an instant when her head had disappeared beneath the surface of the river, when all the color and light and sound had seemed to go out of the world at once. It had been like his own death experienced. He didn't like knowing that his righteous fury at her was really a sort of terror. He asks her how she's planning to continue with her crusade with all its inherent dangers. Is she planning to get help from the Duke? Does he even know she exists? He's already had to save her once from the doctor. What happens if she needs help and he's not around?
Tommy, not used to being questioned, replies as such, quote, I'll manage it the way I manage everything else, she said complacently. That's what I'm afraid of. I don't think you're managing things, Tommy, so much as you're dodging or lobbing events back as they come at you. A bit like lawn tennis. They continue to talk, and Jonathan asks what Tommy wants most in life. Her reply boils down to something so simple. She wants a family. The thing Jonathan has always had. People who were there for him, just as he was there for them. All this conversation then culminates in a kiss. A soft, exploratory kiss that suddenly has potential to be so much more. Jonathan breaks away and they part ways.
Now, while we've been jumping from scene to scene, Jonathan sets some plans in motion. With the influx of cash thanks to Tommy and the pearls, Jonathan was able to get his partner in the color printing enterprise started on their first item for production. It actually started with an idea thanks to Tommy, although hers was a bit raunchier. The press will actually be making playing cards. Specifically, they will make a deck featuring the current Diamonds of the First Water. To help promote interest in the cards, Jonathan enlisted Argosy to place a bet in White's betting book saying that Jonathan Redman will marry the Queen of Spades. Curious, people asked what he meant by that. Argosy tells them that Jonathan Redman plans to choose his bride from a deck of cards that is supposed to be printed. Thus, people begin speculating and orders come pouring in for the cards. This allows debutantes to actually go sit for portraits at the printing press, by our favorite portraitist Wyndham from Chase's book, all to see if they are chosen for the deck and the potential to be chosen by Jonathan as his bride.
This leads us to a ball sometime after the kiss, a kiss both Jonathan and Tommy cannot help but keep thinking about. Jonathan is currently dancing with Miss Grace Worthington, an approved choice of Isaiah Redmond, who is frankly not at all interested in the plight of working children. Quote, well, it's not as though they're like us, are they? They're servant children. No, I suppose they aren't like us. Apart from the two eyes, four limbs, same species, that sort of thing. She nodded, looking relieved at what she interpreted as their accord. He stifled a sigh. It was official. He'd been ruined for purposeless conversations. Suddenly, Jonathan spies a flash of red hair go through the crowd. Tommy happened to be at the ball with the Countess of Maribo and has been watching Jonathan, trying not to relive the kiss. She goes to escape, because watching Jonathan dance with the type of woman he's meant to marry is kind of too much at the moment. And as she's making her escape, she is, of course, caught by Jonathan. Quote, they stared at each other for a moment, and then a wondering smile started at one corner of his mouth and slowly spread to the other. All the tension went out of her, and her confidence exploded into full bloom, and doubt withered in the face of the fact that she now knew there was a world of difference between the smiles he gave the likes of Lady Grace and the ones he gave to her.
This leads to a lot of great banter, which leads to tension, which leads to encounter number one, which is a little bit of hand stuff under the skirts in a darkened hallway. Mm-hmm. You know. And then that leads to a conversation about friendship. Quote, friend, that sexless word, a bloody pity that, a bloody relief too in its way. But he'd meant it. He was honored to be her friend, for in truth, he not only admired her, he half suspected he wasn't entirely worthy of her.
So Jonathan goes back to the ball to dance with the women who his father want him to marry. A few days later, Tommy taps Jonathan for another mission. It's time to liberate a child from the same mill that his father is looking to purchase. The mission goes off relatively well, and Mr. Charlemagne Wilkins is ecstatic to be away. While Jonathan and Charlie are heading towards Tommy and the waiting carriage, Jonathan notices some abrasions on Charlie's wrists. They look very similar to some scars that Tommy has. Charlie tells him it's due to the fact that they chained him up at night. He was trouble, and troublesome kids were chained to their beds when they weren't performing the dangerous work on the factory floor. After they reach the carriage, Charlie proves why he was considered trouble. He's quite an energetic child, to say the least. And Jonathan feels so much like his father. When Charlie finally falls asleep, Jonathan has a moment, quote, "Jonathan shook his head to and fro. They're bloody exhausting. It's always don't stop that. And be quiet or speak up. They're completely anarchic creatures. Animals make infinitely more sense. Children, what else?" Oh, how Violet would laugh and laugh at him. But then he looked at one of Charlie's skinny, raw legs poking out from beneath the shawl, and his gut clenched. Yes, he would steal him again.
When they get back to Tommy's place, Jonathan asks about her scars. She tells him that she was very similar to Charlie, but was lucky enough to escape and make her way back to the house that they are in now. She had lived there with her mother, and the people there looked out for her. Eventually, she had come back in contact with the Countess, who had also known her mother, and while the Countess did not have lots of money, she had helped Tommy out where she could. This information is more of a blow, and he asks her if this was the reason she wanted to finally meet the Duke. Quote, "Jonathan, you and I can only help one child at a time, but someone like the Duke, with his power and name and money, oh, Jonathan, just imagine, what if I told him about what became of my mother and what became of me? Surely he'd listen. It would be unconscionable not to see him. It's time to stop being a coward." She glanced down at her medal.
Jonathan can tell she's scared. She does not understand how hard men like the Duke and his father can be. However, she is determined to speak with the Duke, and Jonathan, too, wishes that she has the success she desires. The next day, Jonathan takes Charlie to the print shop to meet Klaus. He will be a sweeper and general errand boy until he's older and can learn more of the business. The poor boy is shook when Jonathan tells him he'll have good meals, tea, and crumpets. Jonathan, in turn, is shook by the treatment Charlie has endured in his short life. Quote, "The consciousness of what a perilous condition childhood truly is, and that willingness to trust, it was a gift. In a way, a child's trust blessed anyone to whom it was given. What a heinous crime it was to exploit it."
So Tommy did indeed finally have the courage to see the Duke, and it was not a happy reunion. He proved to be uptight and blatantly insinuated that she was a whore and told her she would never get a penny of his money. Luckily, Tommy is strong and can withstand the blow. Quote, "I find it ironic that the hero who faced down his enemies in war and won this," and she dangled his medal before him, "is so very afraid of me." And she curtsied before she turned her back on him and departed, because, God help her, she didn't want her father to think she was a peasant. Jonathan races over to Tommy's place the first chance he gets. While he had hoped the Duke would not treat her as expected, he needs to know. He finds her at her most vulnerable. He asks after the interview, and Tommy breaks down crying.
Well, the tears alarm Jonathan. He does everything he can to comfort her, offering her the shelter of his arms to express her vulnerability. Quote, "And that's when Jonathan knew, with surprise and a certain distant, fatal amusement, that he was sunk. So this is what it feels like," he wondered. "It's horrible and magnificent all at once. And it's even a little funny, given that she doesn't love you." This, he realized, didn't matter. Now, the Duke that brought Tommy so low is a dinner guest at the Redmond House. Jonathan was told to be there, so he is. But he's mad, and he wants to get more of the Duke's measure. When talk turns to the mill that Isaiah and the Duke are looking to purchase, Jonathan brings up the children who are employed there, quote, "and that they're caned and shackled if they're perceived to be misbehaving. They often lose their hair in the machinery or their lives." "Jonathan," his mother warned again. Violet shushed her mother with an irritated wave of her hand. She was watching Jonathan in dropped mouth, avid glee.
The Duke, as all privileged men act, say it's for their own good. The lower classes need to be reminded of their station, and naughty children need to be punished. Besides, this is a common practice. The factory makes the profit it does because of the cheap labor. The children are paid, not much, but they're still paid. Quote, Jonathan pretended to mull this. You're right, of course. And it's not just orphans who work for the mills. I understand that occasionally the unwanted, illegitimate children of wealthy, influential men end up in workhouses. And suddenly, the silence was charged with something threatening and dark. The Duke had walked into a trap and was only just realizing it. So Jonathan exerts more pressure on the Duke. Quote, Jonathan stared at him, neither blinked. Evil bastard, Jonathan said thoughtfully. A gasp went up. Every head at the table shot up and pivoted toward Jonathan, then whipped toward the Duke. Violet looked more cheerful than she had in weeks. Clearly, she should have been requesting a little controversy when she'd been asking for marzipan. He does finish that sentence with a good catch, but everybody knows he was actually sort of saying it to the Duke. It's so good.
Yes. No, it's excellent. However, dinner is interrupted when suddenly Violet turns white and tells everyone something is wrong. She's gone into early labor. The baby is breached, and the vicar, one Adam Sylvain, is called, which cannot be a good sign. Quote, would it take the death of one of his children for Isaiah to realize that love was the only important thing? And then Jonathan remembered that that horrible gypsy girl had said, she will break hearts. Dear listeners, please breathe. Romance is all about happily ever afters, and Violet and her Earl are not about to be cut short. Both mother and child survive the ordeal, and Jonathan has a new lease on life. After all, he vowed his father would not win. Quote, he wanted to be a man Tommy admired, the way he admired her. He wanted her to think of him as brave. He wanted to be better because of her and for her. He was better because of her. She changed him irrevocably. And it occurred to him that the moments in which he had felt most worthy were because of her, of comforting a little boy or holding her while she wept.
Back in London, Tommy is lost without Jonathan. Argosy, who's been trying valiantly to get her attention, notices that she's searching for him. Then Tommy is proposed to by a Viscount, the same Viscount who had given her the pearls she used to finance Jonathan's printing adventure. This was not what she was expecting. She had turned him down for a mistress, saying that the price of her body was his name, but it does give her options. So she begs time to make a decision.
That night, Jonathan shows up at her place, telling her all about Violet's near miss. Quote, I've never felt so useless in my entire life. A faint whiff of bitterness there. Never think that, she said with low ferocity. If only you knew how important you are, how good you are, how necessary you are, to the people who love you. To me. To me. To me. And these words, with this new urgency, lead us to encounter number two, where they finally sleep together. Quote, right side up, upside down, sideways, sitting, standing, you on top, then me on top. A brilliant plan. His shirt fell from his shoulders. Oh, his shoulders, the vast, glorious curve of them. She couldn't wait to lick one. Backward, forward, on the bed, on the table, on the settee. He paused and lifted her dress off over her head with all the ceremony of an unveiling. It fell to the floor. And then, she whispered, and then we'll do it all over again.
Yeah, so this leads us to encounter number three and encounter number four. And as the two take a break from each other, Isaiah Redmond finds Tommy. He tells her to leave his son be. If she doesn't, he'll cut off Jonathan for good, not just financially, but also from his family. Quote, didn't you threaten another son, Mr. Redmond, with something very similar? Tell me, will he be at your dining table this evening? Will you see him tomorrow or the next day or the next day? Or did he, in fact, disappear entirely?
Burn!
However, Tommy does have a lot to think over. After all, she loves Jonathan, enough to know that his family is everything to him. As she's thinking this over, Jonathan comes back for encounter number five.
After this encounter, Tommy tries to distance herself from him. Jonathan knows his father has gotten to her. Fucking Isaiah Redmond. Quote, My father won't win, Tommy. I will. He said it quietly, evenly. It thrummed with the conviction of a blood vow. I'll have everything I want, and so will you. You just have to decide whether you trust me and whether you love me more than you fear the future. They stared at each other in furious, weighted silence. So the two part ways for the time being. Tommy is trying to decide if she trusts Jonathan or if she should marry the Viscount for the security he offers. Jonathan, on the other hand, is moving his chess pieces around the board. The playing cards have orders from all over the place. Tommy's investment is going to pay off big time. And they're getting orders in for the color printings of all kinds of things, including special editions of Miles Redmond's book. Quote, and in every waking moment, in every step he took, Jonathan quietly seethed with purpose. And when his investment in the recent silks cargo finally paid off, nearly triple the original investment, Jonathan Redmond realized he was, officially and quite apart from his family's money, wealthy. Modestly, yes. Certainly not Isaiah Redmond wealthy. Yet. But it was all his.
So he takes his new wealth and the prospective profits from his share in the printing and approaches the solicitor of the mill that the Mercury Club and the Duke of Greyfolk have been trying to purchase. So far, they have not been able to get the deal finalized. Even to Jonathan, the solicitor seems unwilling to sell. Granted, Jonathan's deal is not a full price offer. There are some payments that will need to be made, and he tells the lawyer straight up that he plans to quickly phase out the practice of child labor at the mill. However, there is an even bigger trump card yet to be played. The solicitor spills some water, and Jonathan offers him his handkerchief to clean it up. The man recognizes the initials. It turns out that the lawyer was the man Jonathan saved outside the gaming hell. Quote, it's the oddest thing, Mr. Redmond. I've been inscrutable about my reluctance to sell the mill to certain parties, and it's for the very reasons you cited. That mill is a moral burden to me. I loathe the use of child labor, and the only way children will be treated more humanely, that things will change, is if passionate, influential individuals fight for stronger laws.
Ooh. This man is so impressed with Jonathan, he even tells Jonathan he should run for parliament on the platform of eliminating child labor. He'd for sure have his vote. Ha ha! Oh, and then he sells him the mill, which is great.
Yay!
Jonathan finally meets with his father. After all, the day of his supposed selection of bride by turn of the card is upon us. He gives his father a special edition deck, telling his father to turn over the first card. It's the Queen of Hearts and features one Thomasina de Ballesteros. He also tells his father that he bought him out of the mill. Ha ha. And then Jonathan lays down his conditions with his father. Quote, you will love her. You will receive her in this house. And you will allow Cynthia Brightly into this house. And you will love her too, because I love her. And Miles loves her. And Violet loves her. Because it is you, father, who has caused the upheaval and division in your family. You who are causing your own unhappiness with your attempts to make yourself happy. Not your children. You. And the only thing that matters in life is that you have people to love. Surely, somewhere inside you, you know this.
After that display, Jonathan leaves to actually have the conversation with Tommy. Oh, and the playing cards were a big hit, including the special edition deck featuring Jonathan Redmond's chosen bride and only her. So Jonathan tells Tommy that he drew his bride. Quote, look at it, Tommy, he ordered when it appeared she'd never would. So she looked, and then she looked harder. It was the Queen of Hearts. She was wearing a green dress, and her eyes were a vivid green, rimmed round and gray, and she had a pointed chin and delicate slashes of eyebrows.
It's her, and she's all shocked. And Tommy has a surprise of her own. Quote, when you deposited the money in my account, I used all of it to buy the pearls back from Exley and Morrow. I'll have them returned to Prescott tomorrow. And the dawning of realization on his face was glorious. You believed in me, he said slowly. You trusted me. Of course I did. That, and I love you more than life itself. Yes. And then they get busy with all the children Jonathan is supposed to have.
The end! Except there is an epilogue with this one.
Yeah, there is.
So Pennyroyal Green is all about the gossip. The banns have been read for Tommy and Jonathan, but so far no one has seen Jonathan even speak to his father in public, nor be welcomed in his house. However, on the day of Ruby, Violet, and Ardmaid's daughter's christening, it's pouring down rain after the ceremony. As the Redmond clan is standing outside the church, Isaiah turns to his sons and says, "Why don't the four ladies go home in the carriage? We'll wait out the rain in the pub." And thus, Jonathan gets his way. And briefly, we see the Duke of Greyfolk receive a package. In it is the medal, and quote, "This gave me courage when I needed it. I hope it will remind you of how brave you can be."
Because Tommy don't need him no more. She's got a knight in shiny armor all of her own.
And she's kind of won herself, so.
Well, yes, she is, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, but she's got. She's being a badass. That's all we're saying.
Yeah. And she's part of a badass team now. And I can't wait to talk more about it. So shall we adjourn to the parlor?
We shall.
All right, everybody, we're going to be pretty quick today here, but we'd love to hear from you if you have a book recommendation, if you have an inclusive author you love, or a book you would like everybody to know about, or just a book you read recently that you think was really great and you want to share it. We want to share it. So send us an email at romancepod@gmail.com.
And if you'd like to find us on social media, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at T and Strumpets, T as in Tom and as in Nancy Strumpets, Facebook and Pinterest /T and Strumpets, and YouTube if you search the name of our show.
And if you really want to be in the know, you can, of course, sign up for our email notifications. If you subscribe, you're the first to know what we're reading each month. Plus, you get all sorts of extras, including exclusive content from each of the authors who join us for interviews on the podcast. And our website is, again, romancepod.com. And there you can find episodes, more information about us, and other resources. So take a look.
Finally, rate, review, and tell a friend. Reviews on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or anywhere else you can review us really help other listeners find the podcast. And word of mouth is also one of the best ways that podcasts get found. So if you like what you're hearing, we'd love it if you spread the word.
Everyone, I'm Katie.
And I'm V.
And we are This Lesbian Ship is Intense.
We're a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. And in our podcast, we cover TV shows, movies, and really any other form of media with lesbian characters. We break down shows from a queer point of view. We gush over our favorite ships. And we critically analyze the impact of media on our community. Check us out on iTunes, Spotify, or SoundCloud.
All right, we get to talk about this book now.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I just like it gave me all the warm, fuzzy feelings.
All of the butterflies.
Yes.
So many butterflies. What?
Yeah.
I did not. Okay. So I was like, oh, okay. I don't remember much about this book. I'm not that excited to reread it. Like my memory was like, meh. And like it blew me away. This is a little hidden gem.
Yes.
What?
I know. Agreed. I remembered the thing about, like, I was like, there's something to do with children and, like, helping children in some way.
I didn't remember that at all.
That was, like, the only thing I remembered from the book.
He had 10 kids in the epilogue, but I must be confusing him with Gregory from the Bridgertons.
You are confusing him with Gregory from the Bridgertons.
And because of the premonition or whatever.
Yeah. Ugh. But, it, I mean, it says you're just going to have lots, like, children everywhere, lots and lots of children. And there's this cute line where Jonathan's like, well, I feel like – because he buys the mill and he's like – he tells Tommy, he's like, well, technically, I have 100 children.
It's so great. Okay. And so this book, it's interesting to me because I think that the first chapter of a book tells you a lot about a book. And I think that – if you can have a really amazing opening line or opening paragraph and you can grab the reader from like the moment that you open a book, that's fabulous. Mm-hmm. But if you can really have like the first chapter be absolutely riveting, like I just think that it is such an – like that is the mark of a truly, truly excellent book. And this book is the perfect example of that. This book mm-hmm. has the absolute perfect first chapter. Not one word is out of place. Like I just – I think it's so good.
It just was. I mean like from the moment you open it and then you guys – I highlighted like whole passages of like novel for this and I put like – it was very quote heavy because yeah. I just was like – I was reading through – sometimes I highlight things just to give myself – when I'm doing the notes, I just need like points in the story that are important. So I'll often highlight lines and quotes that just kind of help me tell the story in like a quick way. So when I'm looking over all my highlights, I can quickly see where we are in the story. Mm-hmm. However, pretty much every time I wanted to put like all the quotes in, which is why there were so many quotes, because every time I was like, oh, that's just so beautiful. Oh, that's just so good. Like,
yeah.
And it's just the banter between the two. Like you just, you feel the back and forth with them and they
have so much chemistry.
They do.
Oh my God. Like this was just like sizzling with more chemistry than any of the books we've read recently. Like they were so like – so great, like so great with each other. I just, mm-hmm. I loved them so yeah. much together.
And I felt that Julianne Long's like, I felt by this book, I feel like she's really like hit her stride as far as like gorgeous writing, really keeping the plot super, like everything on this plot. It's, we're not getting a throwback to like Chase's book or mm-hmm. like The Perils of Pleasure.
Or Colin's book, yeah.
Yeah, Colin's book. Like, we're not getting throwbacks to them where, you know, there's so much going on and the plots are wild. Like, this has a very, like, boom, 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 boom plot. But you know, everything has its place.
It all matters. Everything has its place. But you know what? It was also interesting is by page 75, you still don't know what Tommy is, why Tommy is interested in the Duke mm-hmm. or like what she's doing. You know that there's something going on and Jonathan mm-hmm. knows, but you don't give a damn. You know what yeah. I mean? It doesn't, you don't give a damn because it hasn't, the ball hasn't dropped and you're not like, okay, tell me already.
Yeah.
It's just like, you're just waiting and you can't wait like just because it's going to be so good when you find out. Mm-hmm. And it's so much better when you find out that she's his daughter and that's why she's interested in him. And that really like, she's not this just like, she's just so much more than she seems.
Yes.
It's so good. I loved this book.
I did too. I loved everything about it. And then Tommy's scene where he's so mad at her because she jumps off a bridge and she's just like, well, he's like, why didn't you ask for help? She's like, who would have helped me? I've never asked for help. I don't ask for help. Versus Jonathan grew up in a loving family where he had tons of siblings and parents and he was the youngest. So he was like helped constantly. And she just had the complete opposite experience and just for them to kind of connect on a different level. But what I loved too, I mean, I think we should just like, are we going to slip right into that hero heroine
yeah,
rating right now?
I was so
because
feeling
I
it.
I need like, to tell yeah. you all about Jonathan right now. And just like,
oh my gosh.
From the get go, like he has the conversation with his father like super early in the book. And he is like, I put the line in there. He's floored because he's like, these people do. And then Violet reiterates it to him. And he's like, these people don't know who I am. Because everyone's focusing on the black eye he's sporting. No one asked him really how he got it. They assume that he was just in a fight because he was out drinking and carousing because that's all Jonathan does. But no, he got it because he stepped in to protect this guy outside of hell that was being like attacked. And he was like, hey, I'm going to step in and help because Jonathan literally cannot help himself but to step in and help. And that's who he actually is.
And that's the thing. It's like he's always been like this really supportive brother to Violet, but he's always kind of the lighthearted mm-hmm. one. Like that's what we've always seen him. But like really, it's to use a word that we see in Regency a lot, affable, you know? Mm-hmm. But like he just – he's been so great in any cameo we've seen him in and funny and – but not like the one who comes in with the one-liner catchphrase, right? You know? Yeah. So – it's so exciting to see him as a full character because you have an inkling of what to expect, but he just blows it out of the water.
Yes.
Like he is, absolutely. And I love this youngest child thing where he's the youngest. I think he's younger than Violet.
He's the baby of the family.
Yeah, he's the baby of the family. And so the family just like doesn't think about him, right? Mm-hmm. Because Violet is just over the top and all, yes. You know, they have to keep an eye on her. Lion, you know, was the golden child and disappeared. And Miles also, although he was quiet and did his own thing, is a like world-renowned scientist, you know? Mm-hmm. So like they just didn't look at Jonathan. They didn't notice him.
The only thing they ever noticed about Jonathan was that he looked like his oldest brother.
And that he was good at darts.
Yeah.
That was it.
That was it. That's all he had. And it turns out he's like a brilliant investor, you know?
Learned the most from his dad.
Yeah. Like actually like, sat down and learned the most from his dad. And for his father to just brush him off, he's like, but literally like I'm like, you should be proud of me right now because, and he did all this unprompted. He's like, he just feels the urge to go out and make money. He's like, I want to make money and I'm good at making money.
I want to make something of myself. Mm-hmm. And he didn't like ask his dad. He just went and was like, I'm going to prove this. Look at what I can do. It's so great. Let's also talk about Jonathan, like, you know, being a young man who's afraid of children and then like being around children and just being so amazing with these kids.
Oh, it's he's so great with them. He's so cute. No, I love it. Like, we learn about Jonathan's scar because poor Sally had to get stitches. And, you know, because Jonathan asked after Sally and Tommy's like, well, she has to get stitches. But I told her, like, all the best people have scars. And Sally's like, do you have scars? He's like, yeah, check this one out. Like,
oh, there's so many cute moments. And when Charlemagne, who goes by Charlie, tries to like copy Jonathan's speech pattern. And so then he starts telling him like what it's all about to be a gentleman. Mm-hmm. And there's a moment where like they're running away and Charlie has to pee. And so they like stop. It's just so cute. Anyhow, and it's like you kind of know this where Jonathan is like, oh, I really like kids. Yeah, I just didn't know. Like I hate them, exactly. But I also love them. And it's just fair. It's such a great quality. So that is awesome. And also, I'm just like, hell yeah, vote Jonathan Redman. Run for parliament.
Yeah, do it.
Oh, so great. So great. I want to read all a book all about him being in parliament.
Yes, like, and changing the world, right?
Yes, yes, changing the world.
Jonathan Redman, 10 out of 10.
Cheers. 10 out of 10.
10 out of 10.
I mean, can we give him an 11? Like,
He was so good.
He was such a good, such a developed character.
Yes.
And this is a 277-page book. This is not like our last one, right?
Yeah.
Like, or 2 books ago. It's not long. So it's just like, again, chef's kiss.
Yes.
Okay. So let's talk about our heroine, Tomasina de Ballesteros.
I love that she goes by Tommy. She's just like, because she's just like cool and scrappy and like gets down.
She's also so fabulous. Like
she is.
Like she's so funny and interesting and everything about her makes sense.
Yes. And she's savvy and she just like – and even when she has moments like, you know, after the Duke, like she held her head up high. And even after she had her like moment of breaking down, you know, when Jonathan came to check on her – she still like, you know, she cried it out for a minute and then she picked herself back up. She's like, okay, cool. Like that didn't happen.
And I totally meant to mention this about Jonathan because you saying that about that scene reminded me of this because Jonathan knew her father. So her father had been in America for a long time, which is why she'd never had a chance to see him. And that's why mm-hmm. she was just now looking for him. And so when she tells Jonathan that she wants to meet the Duke, he tells her like, he's kind of a cold – he tells her all about him. He's like, he's a cold asshole. Mm-hmm. Like, he's like, but, you know, I – he never stops her. He never tells her she shouldn't do it.
No.
And I loved that. I loved that he wasn't like – he kind of was just like, I want you to know this so that you are prepared that you might be hurt. But he never says, I don't think you should ask him or I don't think you should tell him or you're a fool to do that. He supports it.
No.
It's amazing.
Well, but that's the same thing. It's like as soon as Jonathan – like he – even when they go on the first, you know, rescue mission, like he helps her wondering what that he's like, we're stealing a child. What are we doing? But he doesn't stop in the middle of what they're doing and be like, what are we doing, Tommy? Like, yeah. He just goes along
the
with
next
it.
Day. Yeah.
Yeah. He comes and back. Then comes back and he's like, OK, give me facts here. Like, because I get what we're doing is not technically on the legal side of things. But what exactly? But why? Like, why? Why are we doing this? Why is this important to you? And yeah, like, you know, it's just
it's anyway. So good.
But Tommy also just she's also very frank with Jonathan. I love it. She's always super honest with him, super frank. There's never this, you know,
they don't withhold anything from each other.
And she just I just love her. Sorry.
I love her too.
I wish I could say it better. Like, I just love her.
I wish I could say it too. I'm just going to say 10 out of 10.
10 out of 10.
She's
done.
She's a 10 out of 10. They're so good together. Like, they are literally, like, they fly off the page reading together.
And they just, like, they flow and, like, they banter and it's, you know, cheeky and it's not like true insulting. It's not like one of those books where they're avidly insulting each other, you know, but they're like being coy with each other, you know.
It's so
and they're
smart
just being so sarcastic with each other. And I love it because you have a bit of that whole what was it? Colin was that this book or, you know, where he was constantly calling her by the wrong name. Matilda, you know. What book was that?
Which book?
Was it Colin's book?
Maybe. Oh. Maybe it was Colin's book.
It was Colin of the Bridgertons book.
Oh, yeah. Other,
was it? No, it wasn't that.
No, I think it was. Penelope. I think it was Colin and Madeline.
Yeah. Where he kept just calling her by just random M names.
Yeah. That was
yeah.
First one.
Yeah. But so he does that. But this is the joke is between the hair. He just keeps calling her hair different shades of red. Which are like, at one point calls her hair oxblood. And she's like, oxblood? He's like, maybe not oxblood, maybe mahogany. And she's like, okay, it's whatever, so weirdo. You know?
Yeah. So cute. And, oh, goodness gracious. Oh, there was another thing that I had just thought of that was so, that I really wanted to mention.
This is just on, this is a general thought. I just loved her little Easter eggs of the characters of like Wyndham. The painter, and then, you know, you have the vicar come in and do vicary things.
Yes. So I totally agree. Oh, and Violet and her birth being really hard and difficult. I loved that. It was it was a moment of tension, and she had a breech birth and it was early, but they made it. And so like those are real scary things that would happen at the time. And you know, I was just I really liked the dynamic that it provided to the book.
I did too.
So we've already talked a lot about the quotes of this book and the writing of this book. So it's going to be hard, but maybe we can pick two, but some favorite quotes.
Oh, man. So many.
So I am going to read one.
Okay. Read one.
And it's what I already talked about. It's the first paragraph of the first chapter.
You tell it to me.
And it's a bit long, but it's so worth it because, guys, if you don't go pick up the book, if you haven't read this book, if you don't go pick up the book after I read this paragraph, then there's no hope. You weren't going to pick it up. So, but I hope you do because it's fabulous. Okay. The moon lay on its side like a discarded pickaxe, the stars diamond smithereens strewn all about it. It was a rare, clear London night thanks to a stiff broom of a breeze off the Thames and everything Tommy had seen on her way to her destination. Barrels full of old rain capped thinly in ice, a narrow black cat holding its tail aloft in the shape of a question mark. Each bar on the low wrought iron fence she'd just slipped through seemed etched into the night, distinct as puzzle pieces, shimmering with portent and beauty and danger. Just the way she liked it. In other words, like what? Mm. Are you kidding me? I am ready to freaking go.
Excellent. Just jumped right in. It just hit you with it. God, it was so good. Okay. Mine, I have obviously like lots. And luckily I was able to put most of them in the notes. So, but this one is from when Tommy, like this is like right before he has his realization of love and Tommy like had just met with the Duke. So this is Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't remember crossing the room. He only remembered his hands on her shoulders, turning her to face him. She wouldn't look up at him, wouldn't take her hands from her eyes. She didn't want to see him. So he wrapped his arms around her like armor, making a shelter for her to fall apart.
Oh, I loved that one too. I remember what I wanted to say earlier. It was that Jonathan in this book is the first one to realize he's in love.
Yes.
And I thought that was interesting. Like, sometimes the hero, you know, realizes he's in love first. But, like, this one was, like, really very sweet. I mean, it was just heart-wrenching in the best way.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I have another one. It's so hard to pick them. I'm sorry. I don't even know which one to pick. All right. Okay. I'm going to go with a weird one, even though there's so many good ones. But I'm just going to go with this because this is such an interesting quote.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Jonathan meeting Rutherford for the first time, which is her neighbor who helps protect her. And this is Jonathan's kind of description of Rutherford. Quote, "His voice must be what Poseidon's voice sounds like," Jonathan thought. "It was fathoms deep, as if it had needed to travel miles through him in order to reach the surface. He was lost in admiration at what a creature this man was. He slowly turned around to allow Rutherford to delicately help him from his coat and continued to peer over his shoulder at him." Like, what? The writing in every little thing of this book was just so good. I mean, it's like, ugh, it's so hard to pick one.
Okay. I'm going to say this one only because I think it really, like, sums up why we liked the two of them together.
Mm-hmm.
So Jonathan asks, "Why do you trust me?" he said instantly. She immediately began counting on her fingers as though she'd given this some meticulous thought. "Because you're not a fool. You've a bristly sort of energy that makes me think you have something to prove. You've a look about you that implies a sort of worldly detachment. And you need money, too. You don't know what I think of you. I don't know what you think of me. Which means there's absolutely no excuse to be anything other than honest with each other. We are free to be friends."
I just love them so much. Okay. And they loved each other so much. And that leads us perfectly into our steaminess discussion.
Yes.
This book gave me, I already said it, so many butterflies, like those little fun feelings like in your chest when you're like, ooh, like these two. So many of those. I haven't had that in a book in a long time. Like, I haven't really felt the chemistry leap off the page. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I felt this. And I also felt like their scenes together were very steamy. I mean, we had, what, 5 encounters?
Yeah, we had a lot. And I mean, like, they were pretty, like, rapid succession. Like,
they were.
It was almost like there was a minute and I was like, does this count? I mean, technically there was a break and we, like, had a paragraph of break and then we had another encounter. So I guess it counts as a second one. Like, but once they kind of let themselves go, it's like they are all in. And I just love it because for me, it was steamy. It was spicy. But, like, I just loved the playfulness of it, too. Like,
oh, yeah.
It was just playful. And I think that's why I liked it so much, because it felt natural and playful. And it wasn't like – it felt like the two of them, which I think is what made it the best, because it wasn't like all of a sudden we were, like, hot and heavy and come at me, you know? I read you the paragraph where Jonathan's undressing her and he's just like, all right, here's what we're going. And my favorite is when they start scene 5 – he comes in and he's like, "We haven't done you on top yet. Let's go."
It's so great. So I would say this is a piping hot, ready to drink cup of your favorite tea. It's so good.
Yes, absolutely. For sure.
Yeah. So, feminist recap. They're liberating children from bad working conditions.
Yeah.
Like, feminism is about everybody having equal rights. So I'm going to go with this was a supporter.
I would say that absolutely true, because Jonathan also is all about supporting everybody.
Yeah. And like I said, he never told her not to go do this thing with her dad. He just gave her some information to, like, kind of, like, arm her before she did that.
Yeah.
So I think, like, super supporter. I don't even think we need to, like, go into it anymore.
No, because we've talked about it.
We have. Although I would love to keep talking about this book, but yes. I'm also very excited to give my final book rating. I'm like, as soon as I closed this book, I was like, I'm ready.
tell me your book rating, Zoe.
This is a 10.
Oh my gosh, me too. I just love it.
Tens across the board from both of us. Like, yes. What?
But it's like, it's a 10 for like, it's not like Violet's book, which was like, you know, a 10, but it was because it was like action packed and this and that and feisty characters. Yeah. This was a 10 for like a completely separate reason.
Yeah, it really was. And I mean, I have to say, like, I was thinking about Violet's book because I think I still love Violet's book more than this book, which is unfair to this book because I think this book is better.
But the thing is, I wouldn't even put them in like the same categories.
I think that the love of something like that, though, for me, I agree with you, is that I just identify with that character so much. And yes. So that's like why like that book like has a special place in my heart. But like this book, everybody needs to go out and read this book. This is such a great book.
No, this is such a great book. And it's so – it's fun. It's light. It's witty. But it deals with – it's – but it deals with hard topics. You know what I mean? Like
– yeah, standing up to your family, coming from a difficult upbringing, you know, working against a common goal, you know, working for a common goal of bettering society. Like, what?
Yeah, kidding? But also the theme of like, let's talk about child labor, you know, and let's talk about how these poor children were just terribly treated and like lied and blatantly lied to, you know. It's a heavy topic, but it's dealt with such like this light fun and it never feels heavy. And this is definitely one of those like give you a pickup books. You know what I mean?
I couldn't put it down. It picked me up so much. I was like, I started reading it at breakfast and I was like, yeah, this is going to be one that I finish tonight.
And you're like, this is what I'm doing today.
Yeah, it was fabulous. So I love this book. Everybody, please go out and read this book. It's so good.
Yes.
But, we are on to our next book. So what are we reading next time?
Next time, we're jumping to our other fun family that we love so dearly, which is the Bridgertons. And we are reading Hyacinth. That can't talk English today. Hyacinth's book. You know, the sister that's the youngest, you know that one. Anyway, we're reading It's in His Kiss by Julia Quinn.
Yay. Back to the Bridgertons. We're on 7 of 8. Can you believe it?
So close.
I'm so excited. Yeah. We talked about how it's been a while since we've read her book and hers wasn't our favorite. So I'm excited to dive back into that and see what we think of this go around.
Yes.
And so thank you all so much for listening. Go out there, buy this book and read it.
Yes, please do.
And we do have a link to the book in our show notes. So if you're interested in picking it up through Amazon and you want to buy through our affiliate link, we do get a little bit of kickback, a few cents per book purchase for that. But if not, order it from your local indie or get the new audiobook of it. Buy it. It's so good.
It's so good.
Anyhow, and if you like what you're hearing here, tweet about the show, share us on Facebook, tell a friend. We would so appreciate it. So thanks again for listening. Join us next time as we read It's in His Kiss by Julia Quinn.
And may all your ever afters end happily.
Tea and Strumpets is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts you'll love at frolic.media/podcasts.
Placing them in... Sorry.
Your dog?
No. Yeah, she's been like looking at the door, which I just left open a crack, and she's usually afraid to go through doorways, so she's been like hesitantly like opening it this whole time, and then she finally just opened it enough to make room for herself to like get through.
Aww.
Which is just so funny because she normally like hates touching doorways, but she's like
so funny. She's such a weirdo.
I know she is. Love her. Okay.
There had been an instant when her head had disappeared beneath the surface of the river, when all the color and light and sound had seemed to go out of the world at once. It had been like his own death experienced. He didn't like knowing that his righteous fury at her was really a sort of terror.
I know.
Sorry, that quote is like so good. It's like chef's kiss, chef's kiss, chef's kiss. Oh. Even as I was reading it, I was like, I'm going to stumble. It's so good. Okay, sorry. he asks her how she's planning to continue.